You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The rapid growth and unrelenting brutality of ISIS has shocked most of the world. But although the group has come to control a huge swath of land between Iraq and Syria, our understanding of it remains opaque at best. Graham Wood, contributing editor for The Atlantic, argues that we should not just think of the group as a mere collection of thugs and psychopaths, but instead confront the, quote, reality that the Islamic State is Islamic, very Islamic. His article is called What ISIS Really Wants. It appears in the March issue of the magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome Graham Wood back to our show. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm okay. In the early in your article, you point out that ISIS views itself as a harbinger of and headline player in the imminent end of the world. Can you explain how that apocalyptic situation is supposed to play out according to the group? Is it derived from the Quran? Is it all that different from Christian apocalyptic thought?
It is pretty different, yes, and it derives mostly from a hadith. They believe that there will be various battles along the way, and one of the key ones will be in a place called Dabiq in Syria. They've actually named their propaganda magazine after the city of Dabiq because they think it's so important. They believe they will conquer Rome, they will conquer Istanbul, and the punchline to all this is that the Islamic State will eventually be almost defeated. It will first be attacked by a kind of anti-Messiah figure called Dajjal. And then 5,000 remaining fighters will be encircled in the city of Jerusalem. And at that point, and here's where it really does differ from Christian tradition, Jesus will come back and will come to the aid of those Muslims. And he will spear Dajjal in the back, and he will convert the remaining Christians to Islam. And that will lead to the next and a few more steps in the end of the world.
Don't they control Dabiq now?
They do. They seized Dabiq. Dabiq is not a very important place strategically. But for propaganda value, it's very important. And they spent quite a bit of effort making sure that they control it, which they do today.
Has ISIS made bringing about the end of the world a key part of their military and geopolitical strategy?
Yes, and from the start, really. They had been talking about this long before they became the Islamic State in the middle of last year. It's really a key part of their propaganda more than anything. It's a way that they can tell outsiders and tell possible recruits that there is this cosmic battle going on, and if you want to come from London to join it, then you'll be part of something very exciting.
You're right. The religion preached by ISIS's most ardent followers derives from a coherent and even learned interpretation of Islam. Why do you think that's important to point out?
I think it's important to know that ISIS, even though its interpretations are extremely unpopular, and almost any Muslim will tell you that they derive from an extremely selective and a very selective reading of Hadith and Quran, it's important to understand that these people view themselves as scholars. They have a whole core, a council of scholars that mass produces fatwas and essays about this material. If you really want to understand what the group is, I think it's important that you describe it in terms that even it would recognize. And the traditions that it's drawing from are from this vast tradition of Islam, which is a contradictory tradition. It has many different aspects to it, and this is one of them.
Coming from Salafist and Wahhabist thinking?
Well, yes. They're from even a smaller sect than Salafists. In my article, I profile one imam in Philly who's a Salafist. That means that he recognizes as sources of authority only the Quran, the Hadith, and the early behavior of the companions of the Prophet Muhammad. Even he is a Salafist. He has theological disagreements with ISIS that are extreme. He believes that they are a perversion of Islam and that they must be fought. Their views are a subset of Salafi jihadism, which is itself a subset of this other very small sect of Islam called Salafism.
How do the ISIS leaders view the Saudi monarchy, which is probably the attempt at the purest of all Islamic nations?
Yes, and yet the supporters deride the Saudi monarchy as apostates. They believe it is not just an apostate regime, but as one tweeted recently, a homosexual apostate regime. So they don't view them as Muslims at all, and they believe it's incumbent on them to fight the Saudis and to kill them.
How are they using the word homosexual there?
Pretty straightforwardly. I mean, they are.
Are they saying that the Saudi king is gay?
Yes, they will say that. I mean, it's partly simply derision, but it gives you a sense of what they think of what they call the tyrannical regimes of the Middle East. They believe that these people should be first in line to be exterminated.
I'm talking with Graham Wood, contributing editor of The Atlantic, about his article called What ISIS Really Wants. Last week, the president held an anti-extremist summit and declared, "We are not at war with Islam. We are at war with those who have perverted Islam." What do you make of that statement? Is this a perversion of Islam?
You know, I think almost all Muslims would say so. And as a non-Muslim, it's not really my place to say which type of Islam is the best type of Islam. But also the president's not a Muslim. He's not even a theologian. And, you know, it's interesting that...
You
that
mean Mayor Giuliani is wrong? He's not a Muslim?
Yes. Well, Mullah Giuliani has his views too. But I would say when the president speaks on his theological views... Then the people in ISIS certainly don't view him as having any authority, and really I don't think anyone else does either. What he's speaking, I think, though, is a political fact, which is that the United States wants to make sure that the world of Islam knows that we are not at war with it, which happens to be true.
Some Muslims who are not supporters of ISIS also objected to the president weighing in on Islamic theory and Islamic thinking. You spoke with an academic named Bernard Haeckel who studied ISIS. Does he feel that the West has a good grip on what ISIS is?
I think Professor Haeckel would say that the answer is no. And one of the reasons for that is that very few people do have a grip on this. You know, mainstream Islam is thinking about issues within mainstream Islam. This is not a mainstream group, and the fatwas they put out are not being widely read by almost anyone. So there are very few academic experts, very few people who read this stuff with a keen and intelligent eye. Haeckel happens to be one of them.
We keep on hearing about beheadings and crucifixions and slavery in ISIS-controlled areas. Is the group trying to create a medieval state? Is that based on what life was like when Muhammad was alive?
The authenticity of their project, what they're trying to do is certainly to recreate a legal environment of the 7th century in Islam. They want to take things that were laws that existed then, and they believe that those laws are eternal. Now, they also have a kind of interesting fantasy of what the 7th century looked like. Historians will tell you that their views are ahistorical, that they have a kind of I guess from their perspective, romantic view of what Islam consisted of, and they think of it as a very harsh, arid, unforgiving thing, and that's what they're implementing now.
It is interesting that at the same time they're using some of the most sophisticated modern technology to get their message across.
Yes, and they don't view that as hypocrisy either. I mean, they say that the laws haven't changed. That is, if you find an adulterer, then you must stone her. They think that if you're an apostate, then you must be killed. These things they believe are just a matter of consistency from that period. But there's nothing there that says you can't use an iPhone. Although, by the way, the Islamic State prefers Android.
I'm sure the people at Apple are very upset about that. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was declared caliph this past summer. Do we have a good sense of what his goals are?
We know what he says. We know what his background is somewhat, and he's weighed in public in a couple sermons. That's pretty much it. And he's pretty consistent. He believes that his caliphate must expand, that it will expand kind of inexorably, and then eventually it will usher in the end times that I spoke of earlier.
But does that involve a kind of purification, of ethnic and religious cleansing?
That's step one.
Are we talking about something that's genocidal?
Yes, it's avowedly genocidal. The first step with this group is to kill Muslims. They want, before anything else, to purify their ranks. And that, first of all, means killing Shia, who are, of course, you know, in their Alawi form in Syria on one side, and then in the mostly Twelver form in Iraq on the other side. And so that's really the bulk of the brutality that we see is attacks against those groups so that they can purify their ranks and make sure that, that Islam is pure and that the Islamic State consists of Sunnis of its own type.
But this would not be an Islamic State that would have fixed borders.
No. In fact, that is something that some of the supporters of the Islamic State I spoke to for the article I've written for The Atlantic have stated is that even if Baghdadi were offered a seat at the UN, fixed borders, a membership in the Brotherhood of Nations, if he were to accept it, then that would invalidate his rule. It's part of the aspect of being a caliphate in the Islamic State's view that you must constantly be expanding. It's a requirement and an obligatory aspect of his being caliph that even if no one's attacking you, you have to at least annually attack someone on your borders and make them Muslim or at least remove obstacles for the implementation of Sharia.
Oh, Iraq's most senior Shiite cleric, Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, issued a fatwa calling fellow Shia to arms to fight Sunni insurgents. Do these kinds of proclamations aid ISIS's narrative that they're in a holy war?
I think they do. Now, Sistani's proclamation was a very interesting one. He described a lot of moderating influence that he demanded of people who view him as having authority. But certainly, when there are Shia sources that say yes, it's obligatory to fight this other group, then it does somewhat play into the hands of ISIS. I mean, ISIS would like nothing more than to polarize the world, and especially the world of Islam, into their side on one side and everybody else on the other. That is what their prophecies say. So when it happens, then they say, great.
But it's interesting that when you look for comparisons, you wind up comparing Islamic State leaders to David Koresh and Jim Jones.
I think that accurately reflects the first the millenarian aspects of the group, but also the unpopularity. But you know, one other reason I use that comparison is that there is no question that David Koresh's Branch Davidians were Christian. They were a extremely small minority sect within Christianity, but all of the wacky beliefs that they have are ones that they took from a particular tradition that we call Christianity. And it's the same thing with the Islamic State. They are extremely small. They're millenarian. They're absolutely a death cult. They're also a death cult that draws on a tradition, and that tradition is called Islam.
Now, when you compare what they're doing to some Christian traditions, aren't you opening yourself up to criticism from people at Fox News?
Yes, I think so. I eagerly make that comparison, perhaps for that exact purpose. I mean, there are in Christianity, in Judaism, stonings as well. To argue that stonings are not Christian is part of Christianity. It's part of the history of Judaic tradition as well. It just so happens that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and his Islamic State are taking those traditions within Islam, emphasizing them and implementing them in an incredibly barbaric way.
You write that for some people, apocalyptic bloodbaths fulfill a deep psychological need.
Yes. I found when I spoke to these people that they found themselves in this world of fantasy and imagination, the idea that you could be part of a battle between good and evil in the most literal corporeal sense, a fight against Satan. This is an incredible story to sell to someone, and that's what ISIS is doing when it uses these propaganda stories. It's trying to infuse people with the excitement of that kind of battle.
Well, it sounds like a video game.
Yes, it feels very much like one. And the people I spoke to, they felt, you know, when I spoke to them, they seemed like they might have enjoyed Lord of the Rings, fantasy novels. These kinds of stories are usually things that we can satisfy our need for in fiction. They really are looking to real life.
And you actually talked to somebody who cited Lord of the Rings, and we'll get back to that in a moment. We'll take a little break. I'm talking with Graham Wood, who's a contributing editor for The Atlantic. His article in the current issue is What ISIS Really Wants. We're back with Graham Wood, contributing editor for The Atlantic. He has written an article called What ISIS Really Wants. It's in the March issue of the magazine. As we mentioned before I went into the break, you spoke with one ISIS recruiter in Australia named Musa Serantonio, who you describe as having the unkempt facial hair one sees on certain overgrown fans of Lord of the Rings. Do you think it's likely that had these Western ISIS supporters had a different set of experiences that they could just as easily have become obsessed with, I don't know, stamp collecting or something?
You know, I've met some pretty avid stamp collectors. I haven't found any who really have a kind of totalizing view of stamp collecting in the way that ISIS supporters seem to have.
But they do love mint stamps. Yeah. That's a purification thing.
Yeah, there's definitely a view that you can get something right in this world. Mm-hmm. And if you work hard enough at it, then Islam can be that thing. You know, this is something that I think a lot of collectors and a lot of hobbyists have, but these have it in spades.
Now, there's a certain subset of the population in Iraq, Syria, around the world, which supports ISIS. What do you think the group's appeal is? The certainty that comes with fundamentalism?
You know, the groups that are in Iraq and Syria, who are native peoples of that area, I think it's important to say that many of them have just been caught up in the tide of ISIS. If ISIS shows up in your village in Anbar in the aftermath of this disastrous occupation and subsequent civil war, and it says either you join us or you die, and plus we'll give you a couple $100 if you fight for us, then I think a lot of those people will just join up for that clear political reason. You know, I think, though, that for the foreigners, this propaganda narrative of an apocalyptic war, it's for them that it's probably the most attractive, and it's a matter of doctrine, but it's also a matter of just self-presentation that the Islamic State tells to them that this is how things look. Buy into this, and you're part of our group.
But then there are also those young women who have been traveling to Turkey in hopes of joining ISIS. I can't imagine that they haven't read about the sex slaves.
Well, they I'm sure they have read about the sex slaves because ISIS itself talks about slavery. It claims that there's no sex slavery, by the way, but they openly say that not only do we have slavery, but if you question our implementation of slavery, then you remove yourself from Islam. So if you were to go there and say, oh, well, I think you guys are great, but I don't believe that you have slavery, that must be awful, then you might be next on the chopping block, according to ISIS's own propaganda.
Well, the Old and New Testament both have defenses of slavery sprinkled throughout them, but that doesn't mean that that even the most fundamentalist Jews or Christians are calling for a return to slavery.
Yes, it's an interesting comparison, and there's no question that in Christianity and Judaism there's a history of slavery. The way that ISIS implements it, and I will give you ISIS's defense of the practice of slavery right now. They say that, look, we take over a village, we kill a bunch of men because they're fighting against us. Then what would you like us to do? Would you like us to leave the women and children to starve to death? Instead, we have this institution called slavery in which we own them. We're obliged to give them food. We're not allowed to have sex with them unless they say that we can. And
that's nice.
That's a nice concession of theirs. So they have this view that slavery is a merciful institution. It's also, by the way, they say, permitted by God himself. So that's how they justify themselves. It's not without any textual basis.
And now there are indications that Boko Haram and ISIS have somehow been connecting and been sharing ideas. Boko Haram has also been engaged in slavery, in their case, sexual slavery. But is this a growing movement? So many of the predictions are that this cannot survive.
You know, one nice thing to remember about these groups is that the territories that they control, they're very poor. The people there do not particularly enjoy living there, I think. And so there's aspects to their implementation of Sharia that are just so inherently unpopular among the people who have to live under it that we can expect it to kind of burn out. That said, they have a model of expansion, and that includes not just conquering contiguous territory, but getting the allegiance from other groups like Boko Haram or like groups in Libya. And so they, what they're really trying to do is to close ranks within the groups of jihad around the world. And if they can do that, then they'll have something larger than just the pathetic patches of territory in discontinuous patches of the world like Libya and Syria separately.
Where is their money coming from the sale of oils?
Sale of oil has in the past been an important thing. I think that's been cut off somewhat. When I asked that, so they also have a pretty generous claim to giving a welfare state. They believe that the poor are paid for, health is paid for, et cetera. And so I asked their supporters, where does your money come from? How can you possibly pay for these things in a poor country like yours? And they said, well, for starters, we will confiscate. We have confiscated the property of all those who have fled. So partly they're just burning through their reserves in that respect. They also have this really optimistic utopian view of how society will work in the absence of things like alcohol and other kinds of vice. They think that when we no longer have to have social services for addicts, for example, then there will be this dividend and a lot of money will be left over for social services. So it's partly that they don't have money. They're really poor. And it's partly that they've got I think, very unrealistic views of where cash will come from in the future.
They mint their own money, but what is it based on?
They believe that the gold standard is where it's at. So they've begun allegedly to mint dinars, and you know, it's a metal backed currency. I don't believe it's actually in circulation right now. There might be some collectors' coins out there. So yeah. Numismatists will be excited to get one of those if they can.
I assume that foreigners are sending them money as well. You spoke to a number of ISIS supporters in the West. What was your impression of them? Were they all – aren't many of them converts?
Yes, a disproportionate number are converts. Not all of them, though. Some of the converts are well-known because, of course, if you come from the West, you might speak a Western language particularly well. But there are core groups in several different countries, including the UK and in France, that are well-known for creating sympathizers. And, you know, they believe that it's important that they put out their message and talk to people like me. So it wasn't difficult to get them to describe in great detail exactly what they think and expect.
And you think they were telling you the truth or what they felt that you should know because they are very adept at propaganda?
I think that they were giving me their version of the truth. I think they believed what they said in most cases.
Well, they haven't chatted with al-Baghdadi.
No, they haven't. Although they have close contacts that are in the Islamic State. What they said, though, was consistent with other sources that I've seen from the Islamic State itself. The way that they justify themselves, the way that they talk about what justifies the actions of the Islamic State, they were right on the same page with the official spokesman of the Islamic State, Sheikh Adani. So I think that although they're thousands of miles away from Raqqa, Syria, They have a fairly good sense of what the project is and what they're trying to do.
I'm talking with Graham Wood, contributing editor for The Atlantic, whose article, What ISIS Really Wants, is in the March issue of the magazine, currently out. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You also bring up what the Islamic State calls the prophetic methodology. What's that?
Well, they believe that Islam is not just a religion but a state. And when they say that the state is founded on the prophetic methodology, and that is a phrase that appears about as ubiquitously as e pluribus unum or in God we trust, in fact, in American coins, say, they believe that if they use that prophetic methodology and create the state along the model that the prophet himself, that he implemented, then that's what it takes. If you build it, they will come. The apocalypse will arrive if you correctly implement Sharia law on a caliphate model as they're trying to do.
Now, that makes them very different than al-Qaeda.
Yes.
In comparison, do they also make al-Qaeda look moderate?
In a way, yes. You know, they agree with al-Qaeda on a great many things. There are two things that really separate them. First is that the Islamic State believes that the Shia need to be exterminated first, and they're really zealous in attacking fellow Muslims, whereas al-Qaeda tried pretty hard to attack Americans, both in Iraq and in America. The other thing that they're really into, and in a way that al-Qaeda never was, is the apocalypse. The apocalypse is something that al-Qaeda, I think, as a matter of doctrine, certainly believed was going to happen. ISIS thinks it's happening right now. They think that these steps are already afoot, whereas I think that al-Qaeda's view was that it was more like centuries, perhaps millennia away.
Now, how does what you're writing about affect the possible approaches to deal with ISIS? There have been a lot of disagreement as to whether how much we should intervene, whether we should try to bomb the headquarters where we know that there are concentrations of troops or leaders. Some people have pushed for more intervention, even sending U.S. ground troops. What do you make of the critique that our involvement against ISIS only makes the recruitment pitch stronger?
I think it's certainly true. That is, ISIS, it has a particular narrative, and it's that narrative of Islam versus the West. And when they have those videos of people in orange jumpsuits being killed in grotesque ways, what they're really trying to do is to goad us into attacking. It doesn't mean it's a bad idea to attack, although I think it probably is a bad idea. But what they want is to have images of Western troops attacking Muslims. They want Western troops to show up at their borders and try to take a run at them so that they can have these images of a crusade unfolding. And, you know, that's a narrative that's shared by a lot of jihadi groups. But to have the Islamic State be the one to make sure that it's clear and that narrative is fulfilled in living color, that's something that they want to do as soon as possible.
It's been argued that none of this would have happened if we hadn't invaded Iraq in the first place to topple Saddam Hussein. But these ideas seem to me to have been around for a long time.
They have, but I actually agree with that point, that if the American occupation of Iraq had never happened, there wouldn't be this chaos. There wouldn't be this incredible vacuum of power into which steps this entity, the Islamic State, which at least has the credibility of its consistency and its convictions. And I think for a lot of people, being able to provide security in a way where they understand where the Islamic State places them and what importance it has on various aspects of what it does, that I think is very attractive. And it's only attractive in the context of this disastrous occupation.
But don't some of the ideas, haven't they been promoted by the Saudi monarchy, which, by the way, also engages in beheadings?
So the Islamic State claims that the Saudi monarchy's implementation of Sharia law is incomplete. They believe that, yes, good for them for beheading apostates, for beheading magicians. But they think that Sharia is a huge thing, and you have to do it all right. And if you don't, according to one of the Islamic State supporters I spoke to, it just gets Sharia hated by everyone. So they think that Saudi, by going only on half measures, has really given Islam a bad name.
You write that the ISIS's ideological purity allows us to predict some of the group's actions. In what sense?
Well, they say themselves that they need to expand, that they're chosen by God for expansion if they follow the prophetic methodology. That, I think, is an important thing to remember, because it tells you what confers legitimacy on this project in their eyes. I think if you arrest the expansion of the group, then you do a lot to confound their narrative of an inexorably growing caliphate.
And how do you do that? Because you say, given enough time, the group was simply self-destruct.
Yes, that's my hope. If you make sure that at its fringes it's stopped by, for example, the Kurdish proxies we have in Iraq right now, the Shia proxies we have in Iraq, if the borders are hardened, then I think that when it's contained, it will begin to wither away. This is difficult to know, but it would certainly require them to find a new narrative and to describe themselves in different terms, because what they've said so far to everyone is that we are doing what the prophet told us to do. And because we're doing that, we have a good confidence that we're going to grow and succeed. If that doesn't happen, then they'll have to rethink things and represent themselves.
Well, they are right now threatened with attacks by the Kurds, by the Iraqi army, which has turned out to be less than effective so far, by various Shiite militias. Is there going to be a ground war?
I think there already is a ground war on the edges of the Islamic State.
What about Iran? Iran, which has so much to lose if this group is effective.
Yeah, I think Iran already is operating pretty clearly in the form of Iraqi Shia soldiers and also some Iranians. They're very, very concerned about this group. The good news for Iran is that the group has been pushed back a bit already, and there was a time when it was sort of at the gates of Baghdad, and it's considerably less threatening right now than it was very recently.
Should we not just consider them thugs and psychopaths, as some have suggested?
I think if we consider them that way, then we really misunderstand the appeal of the group. We misunderstand what they think of themselves as. And it's not to say that their view is correct, but when we call them nihilists, when we call them people who are just looking after power, then we really begin to misunderstand why this is such an attractive movement to so many people.
We have a link to Graham Wood's article in the current issue of The Nation. It's called What ISIS Really Wants. The link is on our show page at WNYC.org, or you can pick up the magazine. It's in the March issue. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.